section. Mariela.
Thank you very much, Hans. Good morning, everyone. We have prepared two papers today. As always, we have prepared Agenda Paper 9A, which provides background information about the model, and it also summarizes the board's tentative decisions to date. This paper is just provided to you for information purposes. The paper that we like to focus today's discussions is Agenda Paper 9B, and this paper deals with the discount rate. So at the May and July 2018 meetings, the board tentatively decided that the model would use a cash flow-based measurement technique. That technique would reflect estimates of future cash flows discounted using what we call a reasonable rate, which would typically be the interest rate or return rate established by the regulatory agreement for those cash flows. As a result of these decisions, an entity would recognize the regulatory interest or return over the periods in which the regulatory timing differences are outstanding. However, we have identified two exceptions to this. The first one is described in paragraph 19A, and this paragraph describes the situation when an entity has clear evidence that the regulatory interest or return is provided in excess or a deficit in compensation because of an identifiable event or decision. And in that case, then the entity would recognize a gain or loss in the period in which that identifiable event or decision occurs. And the second exception is described in paragraph 33. That paragraph deals with a situation when the regulatory interest rate that an entity receives on a regulatory asset does not provide adequate compensation for time value of money and uncertainty inherent in the cash flows. And in that case, then, the entity would recognize a loss immediately as it will not fully recover that regulatory asset. So today, what we would like to do is to focus on how to measure regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities to reflect the decision to recognize the regulatory interest or return over the periods in which those timing differences are outstanding. And we would like to run the discussion in a different order to the paper. We would first like to consider the issues relating to regulatory capital expenditures, which are in paragraphs 37 to 52, and then discuss operating expenditures. We would then like you to vote on these two matters and then discuss the third of the regulatory timing differences that we have identified in the paper. So why would we like to start with the regulatory capital expenditures? It is because in that situation, the entity clearly receives or is charged with a regulatory interest return rate that does not reflect the characteristics of the cash flows. And that regulatory rate, return rate, is typically higher than the return needed to reflect the time value of money and uncertainty, because that return, that overall return, also reflects wider regulatory objectives, such as supporting the entity's ongoing activities, protecting its financial viability, etc. So when considering possible approaches, we needed to analyze what information was being given by each of those approaches to users of financial statements. And we identify three approaches in paragraphs 4 to 4 of the paper that result in the recognition of that overall return over the periods in which the regulatory timing difference is outstanding. On balance, we recommend approach 3, which uses the estimated cash flows reflecting only recovery of the original regulatory asset discounted using a 0% rate. We think this approach is simpler. It leads to the recognition of the overall return as revenue, as it is included in the rate charged to customers. And this is consistent with how the overall return provided by the regulator on the rest of the items of the regulatory capital base is also recognized. So we think this alignment results in information that is useful and understandable to users. Open up the discussion now, but we'll ask question 3 at paragraph 52 after we have also discussed regulatory operating expenditures.
Tak. I just want to clarify about when entities should recognize losses with respect to the difference of rate. According to paragraph 33, you said that the entity, in the case of shortfall, the entity should recognize losses immediately.
Regulatory asset.
Yeah. But I was not clear. Is that based on the decision made in July? In July's decision wasn't very clear about the shortfall, because it talks only about the if there is an evidence, then you have to allocate it to the appropriate period. And if there is no evidence, it should be allocated over time. That was clear. But it didn't clarify that if there is a shortfall to the regulatory rate, then the regulatory rate doesn't cover the appropriate rate, then we should recognize the losses immediately. That was not clear in the July's decision.
Mm-hmm.
Because in July we discussed if there is a no explicit rate, regulatory rate, then you have to measure. And then if you feel there is a losses, then you have to recognize losses. That was written in paragraph 16. That was clear. However, when there is a regulatory rate, we have not discussed what should we do in the case of shortfall. Am I wrong, or did we discuss it?
I'm just looking. We had a diagram on slide 18 of the paper in July, but I think we did have a separate question on it, which I'm just trying to pull up where we had the...
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with it, but because I do not really remember, and I was trying to follow the agenda decision, and that was not clear.
While the staff is checking, could I just comment on that one? I leave it to the record keepers to determine how explicit the discussion was, but I think the staff highlighted the key reason as when they summarized it here, which is, let's assume you're in a 10% interest rate environment and the regulator gives you a 4% return. In effect, that is disallowing a part of your claim.
Yeah.
Because it's going to pay you that inadequate level.
Yeah.
So I think when we're thinking about the asset side.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
if it's clear that this is the disallowance, then we should recognize the losses, maybe. That's the clear outcome. But I was wondering, we have discussed it or not.
Yeah, I think it's probably better, rather than trying to delay the time here, we'll double check on that. But our understanding was that if you weren't going to have a right to recover the initial value, then we should be just recognising the value of the right that we've got going forward. But we'll double check. Thanks, Nick.
Daryl?
So a couple of points, and forgive me if I'm a little bit confused in the way I'm talking, because I think I thought through it in the order of the paper it presented, and I'd found the argument in the first part of the paper quite a useful argument to sort of base everything else on. So there's going to be a little bit of confusion in the way I talk about the second one. So I really struggle with the idea of dealing with these two things separately. And then in particular, this part of the discussion I found quite hard to get my mind around. And I suppose the starting point would be to think about the three approaches that you suggested. So it seems to me like approach one, which uses a market-related rate, given that the objective here is to try and determine a reasonable rate at the outset. Approach one, which is a market-related rate, sounds like a reasonable rate to me. Approach two, which is the rate that the regulator applies, taking an all-in cost structure, if you like, also including a rate of return. Also, although it would typically result in a higher outcome than what we expected, felt to me like a reasonable rate. On first reading, I felt like we were missing approach four, which would have been the effective interest rate over the period. Mm-hmm. And I think that's highlighted particularly in your table three. So that would have been a fourth one I would have considered.
Mm-hmm.
That would also provide potentially an effective rate when compared back to market or to the implied rate by the regulator. The one that didn't give me a reasonable outcome was the zero, because that seemed to both avoid the economics, which is that I am being offered a rate, and avoid the market reality, which is that the market would have demanded a rate for time value of something, of a cash flow. And then I think that if I had a look at Table 3, the Approach 3 reflected in Table 3, where in year one I show a value of zero. That seemed to me to be a particularly odd outcome. I know that I'm going to recover the amount. I know that the recovery of the amount has an embedded compensation for time value of money. And so the first thing that I would be looking for is that number. The one other thing that worried me with this approach is if I were to take, I applied the EIR in the circumstance here, and what I ended up with is an EIR of 3.6%, which would still fall within our reasonable rate argument, but in part the 3.6% in the Table 3 example arises because of the fact that there's such a big difference between the rate the regulator is giving me of 8% and the market rate of 3%. If the regulator was instead giving me 4%, I would probably have argued that I'm being undercompensated for time value of money. And that would give me a very different outcome to the one that I've been thinking about in the first part of the thing. So I really struggled with where you've landed in this part of the paper.
My reactions were similar to Daryl's, although far less articulate. So at sort of starting at 30,000 feet, I think one of the challenges I had with the approach in the paper is that while if I sort of look at each of the individual outcomes, the net effect on P&L looks fine, and that in all cases the outcomes are explainable, I'm a little bit uncertain about the complexity of an approach that's making these distinctions between the different types of payments. So I had a reaction to that in the first instance. And then if I look at the second question that you want us to focus on first and look at approaches 1, 2, and 3, I think my reactions were similar to Daryl's, although my sort of starting logic was slightly different and a bit less sophisticated, I think. Because one thing that I found difficult with approach 3 is that this is a scenario where I think we have concluded there is a significant financing component, and therefore where we've concluded there should be discounting, but in effect we've undone the discounting by getting to a 0%. And so that felt a little bit odd. Now, I know that the outcome on the net P&L is the same, so arguably maybe it doesn't matter and it is simpler and I can understand that, but I'm a bit nervous that if we move away from our concepts of discounting and we don't sort of apply them consistently across the model, that where we have differences in timing, which you can see in Table 3, we start to get funny answers. So it sort of works quite nicely in a simple scenario, but I'm a bit worried it will start to fall apart once we get to slight modifications. So my preference, and also I quite liked what I thought for me was an anchor, and maybe I'm kidding myself, it is an anchor, so tell me if I am, but the approach, as I understood it generally, was that what we were doing with this, because we're focusing on the adjustments, is we're sort of explaining sort of basis for the adjustments to revenue, which are a total of 124. And in approach 1 and approach 3, we actually don't actually analyse 124. We're analysing pieces of the 124. So what I quite like about approach 2 is I am getting a sort of, if you like, a full explanation of the total regulatory adjustment that we're sort of explaining the link between that and the revenue line. So I think I get to a similar place with Daryl, but with a very much more simplistic logic.
Mary?
I also in this section struggled with approach 3. And when I think about approach 3, it actually seems to me to be almost the situation we have today, in which in this case, the regulatory return, the 8%, only shows up in revenue when you bill it to the customer, which is the situation we have today without any special model. And if I apply what I think is the logic, and I worry that this is the logic only in my own brain, but if I apply what I think is the logic, I say, okay, the regulator has promised us 8%. I think about what would a reasonable rate be, and I say, I think that's 3%. And then the question is, well, they're paying me more. Is that more for anything, any other specific activity or undertaking. It's kind of what talk was focused on, but the other way around. And I think from the facts you say, no, it's not. There's no other activity, no other promise. So this is just a richer margin. And so I say, okay, therefore, I think that I recognize it over the period, you know, as I am earning my entitlement. And so I think, tell me if I got the quiz wrong, that that brings me to approach two rather than approach three. I think I would only be, looking at the reset to 3% if the rate were, let's say, 2%. You know, and 3% was the necessary one, and I'd probably have some impairment and complexity, some complex calculations before I got to then applying my reasonable rate. And I don't see why I would set it to zero. I think I would, I think our test is, are you getting a rate that is, and this is my edits, at least reasonable? And if it's more than reasonable, stop and think about why. And if you concluded that it's just because you're in an environment where you get that, then it's as earned. It is not a day one gain for the present value of the difference between 3% and 8% either, which is kind of maybe option five that's not on here.
Yeah. We didn't put option five because that had been dismissed
right
in the you're right. earlier meeting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Daryl, you want to add something?
It just occurs to me that I might need to finish off where I was, I think, because I think just listening to two topics that have been raised by Sue and Mary. And I mentioned the approach four, which I thought was the EIR. Now, I think in 99% of the times, if my understanding of how the regulatory environment works, my approach four is actually your approach two. So most of the time, the rate that the regulator gives me is the rate that I'm going to conclude is my EIR. The one exception is the exception that you illustrate in the third table. Now, I think I said when I referred to the third table that I found the answer under approach three in table three as it didn't make sense to me because I was missing out on. Equally, one and two don't make sense because neither of them are reflecting the actual rate.
Yeah.
And hence this idea that EIR seems to better reflect. Now, I think, to Mary's point, that puts me in approach two most of the time and approach three only if there's an anomaly.
Approach four.
My approach four.
Yes.
It's the same as approach two. Yes, sorry.
Not an approach
yes.
three.
So I only get a different outcome in circumstances where there's an anomaly in the way the rate has been calculated. And the anomaly in this circumstance is what the regulators have given me is 0% for 1 year and 8% for 3 years. So my rate is neither 8% nor 0%. It's somewhere in between.
Jen Chow.
Thank you. Yes, when I went through the examples, I have similar concern as Dello and Mary and Sus mentioned. But when I look at the results, sometimes, especially based on table two, its results is the same, and it keeps the example very simple. So I'm thinking whether add some additional disclosure whether can provide more useful information for users. Secondly, I'm also thinking about what's the basic principle behind that. When we look at the return, I think there are two ways to look at. The first way is to look at the return for the regulatory assets you held. When the time passed, then you got the return because you hold the regulatory assets. So it's based on the time you hold the regulatory assets. Another way to look at the return is that why you can get the or additional return or the return, not simply because you hold the assets, regulatory assets. It should be based on the service you provide to customers. So that is based on when you build, the rate at build the rate to the customers. So I think if we based on the first principle, it seems that there are some problems because if we look at the table three, if there is a gap between the return accumulated for the regulated assets and the period which included in the rate charged to customers. In this example, the gap is only 1 year. Mm-hmm. suppose the gap is 5 years, so then it will be a problem, because at the first 5 years, you already amortize the assets totally, and the return will get after 5 years. So it's very difficult to justify it's the return on asset, because assets has been amortized totally. Yeah. So, but based on this, my second principle, if the return based on when you provide a service to the customer, that when you build the money to the customers, it could be justified, yeah, because it's based, exactly you include the additional return in the revenue, as you said, that when you provide a service. And I think it's also consistent with the model we're using, the supplementary model we're using. So it depends on which way we look at the return. It's based on the assets you hold, or it's based on the service you provide to the customers.
I wonder if it'd be helpful at this point if I explained the journey I went through while the team were coming up with this paper, because we didn't end up where I expected to end up when we started. And it was quite a long process, by the way, as well. So, first of all, going back to what we're trying to do, I think we've said that we're trying to account for some of the rights and obligations in the regulatory agreement in a way that separately, because the existing accounting doesn't capture them correctly in a way that provides sufficiently useful information. And it's the what we've been calling the rate adjustment mechanism. And the reason we're accounting for that separately is really because it produces cash flows that have different characteristics from the rest of the rights and obligations in the regulatory agreement. And actually, they're quite like a financial instrument. They're not exactly a financial instrument, but they've got a fairly similar characteristic, which was there was sort of an identifiable start point. There's a reasonably identifiable end point. Fixed-ish in most cases, with a bit of variability in some cases, but it looks quite like a financial instrument. And so the obvious starting point is to think of some accounting that looks like some financial instrument accounting. And that was, in fact, my assumption sort of going into this discussion, and that's where our previous discussion has been leading us to. Now, in the board's previous discussion, we've used this term reasonable rate, which I think was never a particularly satisfactory term, really. It's not something you could really imagine being in a standard, for example. It would need better definition, but I think that was a kind of a holding description while we came up with something better. As the team worked through the paper, we identified these three categories and became increasingly convinced that there wasn't a single description of a reasonable rate that really matches the three circumstances very well. And so I think trying to come up with a single integrated model that covers all three cases in the same way isn't necessarily the best target to aim for. So we decided to look at the three sets of circumstances differently, and then afterwards look back again and see whether there's a sort of a common thread. Now, one of the things that actually pushed me to agree with that was, in fact, thinking about the indemnification, the one we've described as sort of like the indemnification asset, which is a bit different from the other two anyway, but that was sort of the one that tipped me over the edge, if you like. Now, thinking about the RCB, I think the RCB case is the most difficult.
RCB?
The regulatory capital base, sorry.
The second one.
I think that's the real problem child in this discussion. And so maybe if I use table three to kind of illustrate as we go through, so we've all got the same fact pattern in mind. So here we had something that created a temporary regulatory timing difference of 100. I can't remember what the reason was actually, but it was 100 to start with. And as a result of the operation of the mechanism, we're going to get back an extra 124 that we wouldn't otherwise have got. So in total, we're getting the 100, and we're getting the 24 something additional as well. Now, if we were applying financial instruments type accounting, we would say, well, we've got a starting point of 100, we've got a finishing point of 124. What do we do with that? We could do the effective interest rate method, for example. We could do a fair value. There's various different ways we could do that, but we would bring all of that into the equation. Now, I think a couple of you have mentioned our normal discounting principles. Our normal discounting principles would say that if you're trying to measure future cash flows, you would look for a discount rate that is really consistent with the characteristics of the cash flows you're going to generate. And in this example, really, the discount rate that's consistent with the characteristics of the assets is 3%, really. It's not 8%. And I think if you were going with that kind of measure, that would inevitably lead me to say it would be a day one gain if we were following that conclusion through to its normal, that thinking through to its normal conclusion. But then I think that led us to think about two other things. One is thinking about why the regulator is putting it in the regulatory capital base in this example. And I think the most plausible explanation is that the regulator isn't really thinking about this particular item in isolation and trying to reward the entity appropriately for this cash flow in isolation. It's just part of a big calculation, which is on an aggregate basis. It's got some pluses and minuses, but overall, the regulator thinks that's going to give you the right answer. And that's fine if you're looking at the business as a whole, but if you're looking at these separate cash flows on their own, it's hard to say it would really be the appropriate discount rate for these particular cash flows in isolation. Tom?
Sorry, just elaborate for me why you're so convinced that 3% is the right rate. I'm having trouble.
So this
doesn't leap out to me as being obvious.
Okay, so in the fact pattern we've given in the example, we've said that 3% is an appropriate rate for the time value of money and for the risks inherent in these particular cash flows, not the risks in the rest of the business, but just in these cash flows looked at in isolation. So if we thought of this as a sort of like a quasi-financial instrument, if we were trying to come up with a current value type measurement, the kind of rate we'd be looking for would be more like the 3% than the 8%.
So, but then back to why would one be so confident that you'd got, because if 8% is the weighted, is what they're using across all of them, that means if you're putting 3 here, there's some offsetting 13, right? If it's going to come back to 8 for the universe, then. So what looks like 13%?
Well, I might come back to that in a second because that might be the next part of the argument. But I think, remember what we said is we're looking at these particular rights and obligations in isolation. That's the whole reason we've pulled them out from the rest of the regulatory agreement. So in this thing we've pulled out in isolation, there aren't any offsetting effects, or there shouldn't be any offsetting effects.
And we decided no gain, so we sort of got ourselves back.
Let me come back to that in a second. So now the next question is, the regulator's giving this overall return for the whole package of things, not just looking at this individual cash flow in isolation. So the 24 is part of probably a much bigger return on, you know, it's mostly fixed assets. There'll be some other things that are in there probably as well. And probably the reason the regulator's put it in here is because it's not big enough to worry about separately, or they haven't specified it in that much detail. It's just a single aggregate calculation. And the question is pulling out that extra 24, is that going to provide the users with more useful information? Now, I think there are two ways you could look at that. I think one way of looking at it would say you're getting the extra 24 because the 100 happened in this period. So it is a return you wouldn't have had if this event hadn't occurred. And so one way of looking at it would say that 24, or at least the excess, probably the 15, the excess over the 3%, you maybe would recognise that in the period when it occurs, if you think it actually derives directly from that transaction. On the other hand, if you were trying to solve, was the big problem we were trying to solve was that without recognising the regulatory asset, you'd get the expense of 100 at the beginning, and then you would only have the revenue 3 years later. And I think that was the big problem we were trying to solve. I don't think we necessarily need to recognise the 24 in period one as well to solve the original problem. So the question really is recognising that 24, or I should say probably the excess, the 15, the sort of the spread of 5%, is recognising that one piece in year one going to be helpful or not? And to my mind, it's probably not, because that that return the regulator's giving you is just a sort of overall calculation with lots of averaging. And to pull out this tiny piece and recognise that piece now, rather than when the regulator decided when it'll give you, which is in the period when you bill it, seems to me to be not demonstrably better. One other thing that influenced me slightly as well is I think what we're trying to do is make sure there's a clear relationship between the income and expense. And the problem we were trying to solve was the relationship was more difficult when we had the 100 in year one and the 100 return in revenue 3 years later. I'm a bit worried that if we have a lot of moving parts in that regulatory income, regulatory expense line, it may get more difficult for users to interpret that information. So all of those things led me to feel that probably it's probably not helpful to pull out the day one gain. It's probably better to recognize it as the billing occurs. But then I asked myself, well, does it? So in a way, that might push you towards approach two, which says, well, let's sort of pull out the interest type effects and accrue it in the normal way you'd expect for a financial instrument. And we looked at what the measurement consequences are, and the measurement consequences of actually pulling out that extra item aren't typically going to be very significant. If you're billing in roughly the same pattern that you'll be accruing, you're not going to make much difference to the overall measurement. You might make some difference to the components you report. And so to my mind, approach three was a simpler way of getting approximately the same result, but with a bit less bookkeeping, and I think with fewer moving parts as well.
But can I ask you a question,
Lisa?
Yeah. But the table three, where we... So you've got me completely in terms of being convinced that it shouldn't be on day one and it should somehow be over time.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that I then struggle with is where we've had this sort of slight disconnect between the timing of 100 and then when the recovery starts. That's when you start to see a bit of tension.
Agreed.
So how do you respond to the idea that approach three shows no return in X1?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's partly a question of materiality and partly a question of the sort of overall pattern of costs and benefits.
It's sort of fine if it's immaterial, but we can't estimate that up front, right?
No, I agree with that. But I think if you were going to accrue the interest, I think you are introducing extra complications if you introduce the interest. And I think it's a question of cost versus benefits. And I agree with you. Normally, I would want to see the interest component separately. Now, one thing to bear in mind, I think, is that that time lag, in a way, is inherently relatively short, I think. Probably not more than a year or two at the most. And the reason is, if you think about what the regulator's doing, for whatever reason, this is an item they've decided to put into the regulatory capital base. And once they've put it into the regulatory capital base, they're giving you the return on that. They're not really identifying it separately. There's no reason why they wouldn't be letting you build that component period by period as soon as it's got into the regulatory capital base. It just seems inherently implausible that would happen. So I think there's a natural reason why you would start getting some of that return coming through, at least once the item's gone into the regulatory capital base.
Could
Daryl?
So I probably very similar to what Sue said, is that I got comfortable when we previously discussed this in terms of not having a day one recognition, even though I would probably argue there is a day one benefit. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a benefit that you've done something and you're going to get an enhanced return. That led me to the answer which I thought we'd arrived at last time round, which is that we would accept a rate that was higher if there was nothing else that you could point to, and which is what then pushed me into the second answer. The second answer, or the approach B, also seemed to me in almost every circumstance to be just as simple. I mean, you're not actually calculating an interest rate, but what you're doing is you're treating all of your regulatory assets and all of your regulatory liabilities at the interest rate that was granted on the date that they were granted. And so you've got consistent treatment throughout the OPEX and the regulatory capital approach. So it didn't seem like it was unduly... and then, as I say, we get into the Table 3 thing, which I think Table 3 was put in to illustrate why A and B, approach one and two, produce a funny answer. But so clearly they were important in your consideration from a staff perspective, but they don't cover for me why we're comfortable with approach three. And I think I agree with you, it's probably likely to be a very infrequent event, but I think the problem is we're writing these standards for regulators anyway, and regulators may have different methodologies by which they recognize it. So I like the logic that you've just set out, and I think it works, but it just leads me to a different answer at the last step, I think.
And I can understand perfectly why you get to that conclusion. For me, the tension there is pinning it on something like the reasonable rate wording, because the rate the regulator's giving you there is clearly, it's clearly reasonable in terms of their objectives, what they're trying to do overall, but it's not really what we would normally think of as a reasonable rate, just looking at these cash flows in isolation.
Perhaps this is not the opportunity to test it, but in many ways, if I think about that table that we laid out right at the beginning of the process, essentially what the reasonable rate did is it required the entity to test whether something else had happened. Mm-hmm. And if nothing else had happened, it said, well, use that rate anyway. So there was an implied assumption there that even if I set the rate of ridiculous, as long as it was positive, it didn't result in a loss. And as long as there was nothing else I could identify, we would accept it. So I think we're using the word reasonable rate, I think, in a slightly different context. We're saying that is the test, but once I move beyond the test, I use the rate inherent in the contract. So I think I wouldn't put the reasonable rate at the bottom of the process. I think it's the midway point. It's the testing point.
Amaro, isn't the Portuguese term for fair value reasonable value? It is, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, thanks, Hans. I'll consider that you are inviting me to make some comments. I would like to start saying that, thanking the staff for the paper. I think bringing the options was very important for us to have some clarity about what we do intend and what we do expect from the model. And I think this discussion has showed how important it is. And using the examples are very helpful for us to have an idea of the impacts and how this is going to be presented. Second thing that I would like really to commend is the wise decision to start backwards the discussion, because then we can eventually facilitate the discussion, the previous items. Well, that said, I have a similar reaction as I think Dario and others, and mostly I really thank you for your explanation about the thought process and why you get to approach three in this particular session of the paper. But my reaction, I think I would prefer less complex and more simple approach, and applying the same, I would use the term reasonable rate to all regulatory assets and liabilities. So with that, I think approach two would provide this simpler approach for the model as a whole, and would really facilitate the communication with users at the end of the day. I think only to go through the whole thought process to use two different rates in different settings would be much more difficult for us. And I think we would achieve the objective of the project.
Martin.
I agree with staff recommendation, because based on your explanation in 51, I think it is the easiest and simplest approach. And I think all the